We have with us live in the studios, once again, Jaw Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
No Maria this morning?
No. I was about to say there was an unfortunate incident involving an armadillo, but people would believe it, so.
Yeah. She's on vacation out in Chicago.
Yes, she is.
I have to imagine it's hot out there, too.
Yeah, so the incident probably involves a cow and a lantern, but...
We'll leave that to people's imaginations.
Yes.
All right. So starting out with local and Rob McKenna making the news.
Yeah, the state attorney general is at it again. There's a report in the local blog Publicola this week that McKenna is ready to settle on a case that the attorney general's office and the state pharmacy board have been litigating against an Olympia pharmacy that's refusing to prescribe emergency contraception. And this, as you'll remember, there was a whole brouhaha around this last year with the pharmacy board trying to enact regulations that would protect the consciences of right-wing ideologues who think that emergency contraception somehow equates abortion or that it's a fertilized egg. They've got the biology wrong, essentially, is what it comes down to. But there are a few of these pharmacies around the state, and McKenna's office was charged with trying to enact the regulations that would require that the pharmacies, if they don't honor the prescriptions themselves for emergency contraception, that they refer the customer to some other nearby pharmacy that does provide that service. Because, of course, pharmacists have an ethical obligation to fulfill prescriptions when they're prescribed. The report in Publicola this week was that McKenna is backing off of this and not requiring that a pharmacy refusing to fill the prescription would provide this, just asking them provide that if the patient asks for it, then they have to have that information on hand. But they don't have to volunteer it. They don't have to make sure that the prescription actually gets filled. And this is something where, once again, McKenna's political ambition and his ideology are getting in the way of his enforcing the law, because in the course of the lawsuit that had forced this potential settlement, they'd actually won in court at two different levels. And then the pharmacy in Olympia has continued to appeal this. But there's no question that McKenna has the right to enforce a much more stringent standard. He's just not actually doing it. And this gets back to another topic that we talked about last week on this show, which is the hearing that was held in the Washington State Supreme Court this past week on a lawsuit by Department of Natural Resources head Peter Goldmark, who wants to try and appeal a lower court ruling against the DNR by an Okanagan County PUD that wants a right-of-way for a transmission line in state-owned forest land. Well, this would ordinarily be a pretty mundane sort of squabble between two public agencies. But once again, you have McKenna refusing to provide legal counsel to a state agency that has requested it. And the state statute not only requires McKenna to do that, but it also prohibits Goldmark from retaining another attorney instead of the AG, so that Goldmark actually has had to go to court pro se, just representing himself, in order to try and force McKenna to provide the representation that he's legally forced to provide. The hearing at the state Supreme Court this past week suggested that the Supreme Court justices were looking very dimly at McKenna's refusal to do this. But once again, because McKenna is sort of the golden boy of state media, and particularly the Seattle Times, none of this is getting reported. So McKenna is not doing his job. He's pursuing things in a very ideological way. He's pursuing things as with his joining on to the Republican lawsuit against Obama's health care reform bill in a way that is very much appealing to the Republican base and his rumored interest in running for governor in 2012. And the Seattle Times and various other state media are letting him get away with it. It's a very problematic issue.
One would think that potentially, though, if he does pursue the seat of the governor, that could hurt his reputation if challenged publicly about that.
Yeah, but of course that only happens if there's actual media coverage and people are actually aware that these issues are going on. So, you know, we're doing our part, but the number of people who listen to this show as opposed to the number of people who read the Seattle Times or watch television news is pretty small. So, but we are a unique and well-informed audience. So,
I like to think in terms of quality over quantity.
Exactly. Yes.
All right, moving on. You are,
and we're all good friends, so
we are. Yeah. You are anticipating a special legislative session coming up?
Yeah, this is something else that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, that it's looking like the state legislature is going to have to be called into special session sometime in the next few weeks. What's going on is that Congress adjourned for the 4th of July holiday, which is an extended break. And then, of course, as you move into the midterm election season, it gets harder and harder to get anything done. But it has not done something that's essential to the state budget, which is that the budget, which is legally required to be balanced, used as one of the things that helped with that balance, an anticipated $460 million in federal reimbursement for Medicaid monies. That money, unfortunately, is not forthcoming because of the backed-up calendar and Republican obstructionism in Congress. Congress has not passed the allocation for that money out and sent it on to the president, and it doesn't look like that's going to be happening anytime soon, so that Governor Gregoire and the state legislature are going to have to go back to the table and enact another 7.5% or so in budget cuts, either across the board or tailored to specific areas of the budget, to try and get a budget between now and the next biennial budget, which will be determined at the legislative session, next January. So, it looks like once again there's going to be a whole another round of cuts, and that's very likely to affect things like, school teachers and, money for education in the coming school year and things like that that are already pretty much stretched to the limit in terms of their ability to absorb cuts.
Wow. So when do you expect that session to start?
I would probably say sometime next month, but it really has to do with when the governor and the Democratic leaders of the House and the Senate decide is best for people's schedules to try and reconvene people.
All right. Okay, moving on, a local Hemp Fest happens every year.
Yeah, and this year Hemp Fest was attempting to expand from its past 2 days to 3 days. Now, the past several years, as anybody who's attended has known, it's been extremely crowded. Upwards of a couple hundred thousand people have crowded into Myrtle Edwards Park, which is this long, narrow strip of land on the waterfront north of Belltown, that it gets very, very crowded, especially around the entrances. And so Hemp Fest, because of cited concerns around security issues and safety issues, was trying to make it a 3-day festival on the idea that most people will only come once over the course of the weekend, or at least a majority of people do, and that if you spread the crowd out over 3 days, it will be a little less crowded. The city, citing budget constraints, had refused to do this. Hempfest had appealed through the city, but it's gotten to the point where it's so close to the event, which happens basically, 5 weeks from now, the third weekend, I believe, in August is when it takes place, that there's just not time to, at this point, to plan for expanding to a 3-day event. So there will be a reception on Friday night that was already planned, that's not tied to Myrtle Edwards Park, and then the regular 2-day festival. So it's going to be very, very crowded once again this year. And the reason it's going to be very, very crowded, aside from the popularity of the event, is that the city wasn't willing to spread it out over 3 days. This also gets us back to a time when the relationship between the city and Hemp Fest is much more adversarial than it's been in the past few years. It's not an ideological thing at this point. At least it doesn't appear to be. Much more an issue that the city just doesn't have the budget for things like another day of police overtime for providing security and providing logistics for the park.
All right. And finally, on local, it appears there will not be another trial with a local deputy.
Yeah, Paul Sheen, I believe is how you pronounce his name, the former King County deputy that was videotaped beating a teenage girl in a cell, has gone through two hung juries now around whether his case was not just police misconduct but also criminal misconduct. So King County Prosecutor Dan Sederberg has announced that he's not going to He's not going to try and retry the case again. This underscores, as with the case of the transit cop in Oakland who was convicted only of involuntary manslaughter this week, in the case involving Grant, the young African-American who was shot at point-blank range in the back at a transit stop in Oakland. This underscores once again how difficult it is to prosecute any cases of police misconduct. There has been no inquest in the history of King County that has found anything other than justified use of force for deaths involving law enforcement and unarmed civilians in the history of King County. It's really a remarkable record, and that also trickles down to less serious incidents such as the one in the beating cell, where it's just very, very difficult, even though there's certainly been a long history of mistrust in the community and various incidents that have, especially in the age of cell phone videos, been taped and made their way to YouTube. It's very difficult to prosecute these things, and it underscores again, once again, how in the absence of that kind of accountability, you really need a police chief that can work to mend the relationships with communities that distrust the law enforcement. And that brings us back again to the recent selection of a new police chief that's almost guaranteed to not do that for the city of Seattle.
But the particular deputy wasn't part of the Seattle Police Department.
No, that wasn't Seattle Police Department. That was King County. But, you know, to be honest, I don't think people make a lot of those distinctions. They see a guy in a uniform with a gun, and they don't really notice which department he's coming from.
All right. Moving on to national and starting with the Defense of Marriage Act.
Yeah, a very interesting ruling federal court in Boston this week. U.S. District Judge Joseph Taro struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Basically, it was a good ruling for the wrong reasons. Taro cited primarily the violation of the 10th Amendment in that the Constitution, according to his ruling, provides that states rather than the federal government should regulate marriage, and therefore the basis of the lawsuit was that Massachusetts was being forced to discriminate against gay couples because federal Defense of Marriage Act prohibited the federal government from reimbursing for, I believe it was, Medicaid expenses at the same rate for a married couple because the federal government didn't recognize the marriage. This unfortunately is almost exactly the same reasoning that was used by federal courts before the Supreme Court finally struck the whole thing down. But in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, the federal courts routinely ruled that this sort of states' rights reasoning was what allowed laws prohibiting mixed-race marriages to stand on the books, saying that states rather than the federal governments had the right to regulate marriage and they could do whatever they want with it. Now, to his credit, Taro also did cite the 14th Amendment, which, you know, prohibits classes of people from being treated unequally as a reason for striking down another related lawsuit. But it was the 10th Amendment that got most of the attention on this. And, of course, that also is the amendment that a lot of Tea Partiers and tea baggers have been very focused on, the whole idea that you can prohibit all of the policies at the federal level that you don't like. Particularly, this has come up around the health care reform issues, by citing the 10th Amendment and saying that's an unconstitutional abrogation of states' rights. There's a long history in this country of using states' rights as a way to justify racism and discrimination against people, and the fact that in this case it's being used to justify giving people rights when it's unpopular, as opposed to denying people rights when other parts of the country are demanding it, doesn't make the rationale any better, because that same rationale can be used in the vast majority of states, including Washington states, where state equivalents to the Defense of Marriage Act are on the books that prohibit gay marriage. So you could use this same ruling to justify Washington State, for example, banning gay marriage, even though it discriminates against a class of people by refusing to allow them to get married.
All right.
By the way, the Department of Justice in that case almost certainly will appeal. The case will certainly go to the Supreme Court. In the case of the mixed-race marriages, it really took society changing in order for the Supreme Court to catch up to it and say that you know, you had to have a decade of the civil rights movement before in 1967, Loving v. Virginia, the Supreme Court ruling that mixed race bans in marriage were unconstitutional. And unfortunately, particularly given the two stolen elections of George Bush and the Democrats ruling over and playing dead when Samuel Alito and John Roberts were nominated to the Supreme Court, we're going to have a Supreme Court for the next 20 years that's going to be way, way behind society on this issue. So even though this ruling is likely to be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, don't expect the Supreme Court to be, you know, legalizing gay marriage anytime soon.
All right. On that happy note, moving on to the Department of Justice and Arizona's recent immigration law.
Yeah, the Department of Justice, by the way, is also going to, as I say, appeal the DILMA ruling, because that's what the Department of Justice does. It acts as a attorney for the federal apparatus, even when Congress passes bad laws. That is in direct opposition to what Rob McKenna is doing at the state level. Just thought I'd point that out. But, yeah, the Department of Justice also filed suit this week to overturn SB 1070, which is the immigration law that's going into force this month in Arizona. This actually is a pretty courageous act on behalf of the DOJ and the Obama administration, because public opinion polls show that by about a 2-to-1 margin, the public in the United States supports the Arizona immigration law, which is really a pretty frightening statistic, given the kind of likely level of abuse and racial profiling that is likely to result from it. The rationale behind this is directly opposite of the 10th Amendment rationale. It's that the Constitution specifically provides that the federal government rather than states will handle immigration issues and border issues, and the state doesn't have a constitutional right to take on that kind of policy on its own. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out and whether there will be an injunction put in place to prevent this law from being enforced until that lawsuit works its way through the courts. It almost certainly will wind up in the Supreme Court, I think.
It's interesting seeing the things the Department of Justice challenges these days.
Yeah, or doesn't challenge, yeah, as the case may be.
All right. From there, this week's economic news.
Yeah, a very interesting report in the New York Times that came out this week that pretty much undercuts the whole rationale that a lot of right-wing commentators have had, that the reason behind the mortgage crisis and the reason for the high rate of defaults in real estate has been federal programs that encouraged the poor and people who couldn't afford high-cost mortgages to get those high-cost mortgages, and the variable rates and the balloon payments and so forth that we've talked about so much on this program. Instead, what the report found was that the wealthy have stopped paying mortgage on their houses at a much higher rate than anybody else. Specifically, over 1 million homes that are valued over $1 million are defaulting at a rate of some 23%, as opposed to less than 10% for houses under $1 million. And that makes a lot of sense for the specific reason that if you're extremely wealthy, you've got more than one home. And you're treating that second home or a third home or whatnot as an investment property. You may not be living in it. You may be renting it out. You may not, you know, you may just be sitting on it waiting for the property value to increase and whatnot. And you're treating it as an investment, and you're willing to bail on that investment much more promptly than if you are using that house as your primary residence and have to move and don't have any other options for where to go, which is the case for most people who actually own homes, who only own, you know, one home, unlike, say, John McCain. So it really underscores that a lot of the housing bubble and a lot of the collapse of the housing bubble had to do with the speculation in the real estate market and people who were buying real estate for investment purposes but not using those houses as their primary residences. And those are there's still a lot of people who are using primary residences who are defaulting as well and who are in a world of hurt, but an awful lot of the crisis can be traced directly to people who are trying to flip homes or trying to use them as investment properties rather than using them as primary residences. Or they just needed a third vacation home in the Hamptons, whatever.
So there's going to be some pretty nice places to squat coming up here soon.
I would think so, yeah. You know, if there's anybody listening to this out of a battery-operated radio in a dark house in Laurelhurst, you go.
All right. Well, got about 8 minutes left here. So next up, BP.
BP, yeah. Yeah, there's... This is very silly. BP is once again saying that we're only a couple of days away from possibly capping the well. We have heard this before. In this case, a new cap being put on the well that, oh, by the way, over the next 4 days or so will allow a lot more oil to gush into the Gulf of Mexico. And then hopefully will stem most of, not all, but most of the flow. So we'll see whether this happens or not. But in the meantime, it's been very interesting over the last couple of weeks to see that the media coverage of the oil slick and of the effects of the oil spill and the fact that it continues to spread, and there continue to be these increasingly dire scenarios about not just the immediate effects on the ecosphere and the biosphere in the Gulf of Mexico region, but also the larger effects on ocean waters, on the economy in the southeast and so forth, and on the culpability of BP and its willingness to pay for the damages for all of this. That really has disappeared from a lot of mainstream media. There hasn't been nearly the attention to it that there had been up until about, oh, I'd say the first or second week of June. And it's almost like, we've moved on now. It's summer. We don't want to worry about those depressing things, yada, 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 when, in fact, you still got an unprecedented environmental catastrophe that's certainly the worst in this country's history going on in the Gulf of Mexico. And nobody seems to be very much talking about it anymore.
I know they had an article this week. AP came out pointing out that there's, I believe it was 27,000 abandoned wells in the Gulf of Mexico that aren't being
Yeah, and for anybody who's actually spent time down in that part of the country, it's very common to find beaches with globs of oil on them. I mean, it's not like this has ever been an environmentally pristine area, especially along the Texas coast. And then if you go down into Mexico and in Tamaulipas and in Veracruz states, there's a lot of beaches with globs of oil on them that are really pretty unappealing. And of course, the worst oil spill in the history of the world happened off the Mexican Gulf of Mexico coast in Yucatan. So, yeah, this is not totally unprecedented, but it's still, you know, very, very serious. And the fact that the federal government has been almost entirely willing to let BP call the shots on this, you know, the $20 billion in damages that were set aside in an escrow account by Obama were a very nice start, but it doesn't begin to touch the actual damage to this, nor does it begin to touch BP's quarterly profits, which are in excess of that. So it's not like they can't afford to do more. They just, you know, haven't been asked to and haven't been forced to. And you also wonder why as we see more and more reports coming out of BP having cut safety corners, ignoring warnings that this sort of thing could happen, et cetera, why some of these executives that signed off on some of these cost-cutting measures that compromise safety, why they're not in jail? Because, you know, that's a whole lot more harm to society than somebody stealing a candy bar from a convenience store.
Yeah, another, as we had two different segments this morning on the local situation here with oil and BP, and one of the fallouts is that the local skimmers are being pulled out of place here in Washington State, going down, you know, to the Gulf to serve there, but we have, like, no protection when everything is left here.
Yeah, and we talked also on this program a couple of months ago before it got obscured by the Gulf of Mexico incident. There was an incident off the coast of Australia where a tanker dumped a load of oil into the area right adjacent to the Great Barrier Reef because they it didn't have a tugboat. It was pilotless and went off course and rammed the reef. And this gets back to the whole question of tugboats going through the Strait of Juan de Fuca and safety measures there, which the oil and shipping industries have been fighting Coast Guard efforts to do that for years and years and years, and that hasn't gotten much attention locally either.
And then the other oil-related item that came up this week was the report that BP is, in fact, the DOD's largest supplier of oil and fuel.
Yeah, and that's something else that people aren't aware of is the environmental cost of the military in this country, that the military is by the U.S. military is by far the world's largest polluter and the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. And when you talk about environmental degradation, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are environmental catastrophes as well as human catastrophes. If you want to do something for the economy, or for the environment rather, and the economy for that matter, stopping those wars would be an excellent idea. But that doesn't seem to be happening just yet.
Fred Fellman, who was on at 7:30 and has worked extensively trying to correct BP's problems.
An amazing activist who's been doing good things for many, many years.
He wrote recently that the public has a unique opportunity to use this disaster as leverage to cut off BP's contract with DOD unless they make some serious changes to the way that they do business.
I would think that'd be an excellent focus of activism. And the other interesting thing that's going on is I saw a report this week that in Michigan in the upper Midwest that various gas stations are changing their affiliation from BP to other oil companies, not like, say, Shell or 76 are environmentally responsible themselves, but just because the demand for BP gas has plummeted. Whether it's as a result of specific boycott calls or just because of people's, general and focused disgust, that sales have really dropped for BP. And that's a good thing. They should be punished at the gas pump for doing this.
I know once upon a time that Citgo used to be exclusively gas from Venezuela.
That is no longer the case. Citgo is owned by that, but Citgo used to be distributed through 7-Eleven, which meant there was a lot of Citgo gas in the Seattle area, and 7-Eleven dropped Citgo for political reasons, actually. They were pressured to do so by the Bush administration, as I recall. They dropped the Citgo gas in, I believe, 2008. And since then, it hasn't been available in the Seattle area, which is, unfortunate.
All right. Another quick minute to go. Last week, you talked about the problems with Seattle Public Schools.
Yes.
And I know this week there had been a review. I don't know if you caught that in the paper.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I talked about last week that was coming up, that school superintendent Maria Goodloe Johnson was up for a contract extension this year, and that in fact did happen, I believe. Despite the public opposition and despite a lot of testimony for a lot of the problems that we talked about last week, that she's got another year in her contract through, I believe now 2013. Got a rubber stamp of approval from the school board for continuing to pursue policies that, to put it gently, have been rather divisive, around school closures, around, standardized tests, and around a lot of conflicts of interest that she personally has, with testing agencies and various companies that do business with the school district.
So, yeah, I believe that was a 5-2 vote. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a fine, fine website. I'm so accustomed to saying you can find us wherever you find free papers, but that's not really the case, although it will be in a couple weeks when we do our endorsement issue. But for the time being, we're publishing stuff every week on our website and a blog that's updated much more frequently than that. You can find us at www.eatthestate.org. We are, incidentally, looking for both a new calendar editor and a new co-editor because we had people leave town on both of those things in the last month or so. So if you're interested in that, you can email us at editorial@eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, anything you hear on the show, once again, info@eatthestate.org.